that Jesus himself said that he did not come to do away with the law.
This is the Adventist Pilgrimage Podcast with your hosts, Michael Campbell and Greg Howell.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Adventist Pilgrimage Podcast. We have got a pretty cool episode here this week. Just to kind of look at a couple of different details from the last few. If you haven't listened to our previous podcast on Last Generation Theology, we definitely want to encourage you to do so. We've had a little bit of discussion, kind of pulled in some folks there on social media, looking at it from a few different angles. So if you're interested in any of that kind of thing, do check out our last couple episodes. But this week is a special episode for me because I get to kind of highlight my co-host's effort, work, drudgery in some cases. Going through old historical stuff is a lot of effort, but he has produced an amazing book for us here. Michael's just put out his book, 1922. And what's really cool about this book is that it's kind of picking up right where his previous one left off, albeit about 3 years after the fact. His other book, 1919, if you haven't had a chance to check that one out, looks at that time period and the Bible conference and the church that took place. So this next jump 3 years ahead in 1922 just kind of rolls right on through in this early, the first couple decades of the 20th century. So, Michael, share with us a little bit today what your thinking was as you were approaching this 1922 book.
So thanks, Greg. Yeah, I'm really excited because I've always been interested in this broader Adventism and fundamentalism. But George Knight and when I was doing my dissertation, had encouraged me to focus and narrow down just on 1919. So that's my dissertation topic. And then, of course, I popularized that in my recent book on 1919. But I've always had this hunkering to want to go back and look at the broader narrative of what's happening with Adventism and fundamentalism through the rest of the 20s. So this is my first attempt to really kind of take that next step and explore what happens, kind of like the rest of the story, Greg. And
yep, Harvey moment here.
Right, yeah. So that's kind of what's happening in the aftermath of 1919. What happens next? And this is not the end either. I'm already, I wasn't able to take all of the material from 22 and put it in my 22 book. So I'm going to have yet another volume. So I may end up most likely becoming a trilogy. So,
Which would be great.
I'm thinking, yeah.
All good things come in threes. We know that.
I guess. Yeah. So there's still so much more. And of course, we dabbled with that a little bit with Last Generation Theology. But 22 was exciting because I just kind of poured through our church periodicals and publications after 1919. And there was just a bunch of stuff that I didn't realize was there by taking a little bit more time. You know, the statements of belief from 1919, 1920. I mean, almost really by the end of the year in 1919, you see these direct correlations between, and of course, correlation's not causation, but in this case, there clearly is a catalyst because Adventists are reading the fundamentalist statements of fundamental belief. And of course, they had their own before this, but they're directly engaging or interacting with these fundamentalist lists of belief. And then saying, hey, here's our list of fundamental beliefs, and we agree with most of it, except for there's a few tweaks or whatever. And so yeah. When I saw that, I said, aha, this is amazing. I've stumbled on something really significant that no one in Adventist historiography has ever written on before.
Yeah. Yeah, no, that's honestly what made this book so exciting for me, because I've always had the same sense that we've got pivotal stuff happening in the early 20s that we just have never really tapped into. But in reading Adventism, I've always felt like we've got an Adventism before fundamentalism and an Adventism after it, and they're not the same. It doesn't feel like the same beliefs, or at least it doesn't feel like the same emphases. I've always felt that. And you've highlighted and figured out exactly what kind of course corrections and changes happen. So let's just kind of kick it off.
Yeah.
Oh, no. Keep on going.
Well, I was just going to say, and there's some interpretive aspects to this as well, because some people have tried to interpret this in different ways with this broader sense of what you're pointing out, Greg, of fundamentalism. And I think it's really important to define that term, because a lot of people throw and banter that about Some people use it in a pejorative sense, and I'm not meaning it in any way like that at all. I'm using it in a strictly historical sense. There's a historical fundamentalist movement in American religion, and Adventists are part and parcel of what's happening within that wider cultural milieu.
Yeah, and we're discovering it in a lot of ways, along with the people that are involved. I've always looked at the fundamentalist movement. I mean, obviously Marsden and some other guys have their own views on what the term means, but I've always felt that it was a moment in time where everybody was deciding, what are we going to truly focus on and what are we going to truly try to fight and defend for? Like, we've all had this Christian sense as Protestants in America, and yet now we're going to focus on the issues that we really think need to be defended. So that's always been kind of my sense of it anyway.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely.
So let's kind of kick it off here. In reading through the book in the first few chapters, I noticed a great quote here that I thought I'd just throw out that I'd love to hear a little bit more exposition on. You mentioned in the first, might have been the introduction, you said fundamentalism perpetuated a siege mentality. Several historians noted how such a mindset was based on this foundationalist view of truth, the idea that all truth had to be black and white and therefore propositional. That you said set up a kind of an idea here that there's a widening chasm between the conservative and liberal viewpoints because you needed to define truth from error so strongly, which itself, funny enough, is based on a modern sensibility. Even though the conservatives are saying we need to defend and highlight what is truth and what is error, the drive to defend truth and error in a black and white dichotomy is itself a modern way of thinking. And I'd love to hear a little bit more about that.
Yeah, and this is, you know, some of the great historiography that's been going on by a number of historians and philosophers and theologians is that, yeah, there's this binary. It's a way of viewing the world. And so while you can define fundamentalism as a historical movement, there's also, it's an ethos. It's a mindset. It's a way of thinking, a worldview even. And very much as I mentioned in my book, which you just referenced, this kind of binary, this black and white way of thinking, everything is very much in both sides. The modernists and the fundamentalists are both engaging with modern sensibilities and a way through which they view the world that is distinctly modern. And so you divide up the world by science and scientific thinking. You categorize things. You even this notion within Adventist theology of proof texting, while there had always been a kind of a penchant for doing that, it takes off in a whole new kind of way because you're kind of categorizing, for example, Ellen White's writings and coming up with lists of proof texts through which you identify and hold up suppositions of truth. And so all of these things and the predilections as to why they're doing them are very much informed by modern assumptions. And so both, yes, the modernists and the fundamentalists, they're taking two different ways of responding to this new world and to change, but still they themselves are the product of the world in which they live too. And so, yeah, this is huge, I think, for understanding. Our pioneers were people of their own time and place. It wasn't a tabula rasa, a blank slate where they just walked in and said, they had their own environment and ways of thinking that were shaping their world in which they are interacting with and reacting to. And so, yeah, the fundamentalists are part of that kind of knee-jerk reaction in a way, like, hey, I'm not liking some of this change, even as they're still very much utilizing modern assumptions. And so, yeah, both sides are very much modern, whether they like to admit it or not. And it's easier for us looking back after a century to kind of see that, but it should give us pause for a little bit of humility to ask ourselves the same kinds of questions. You know, how are we influenced by our wider world and culture today?
Yeah. And to me, that was the irony of it. Like, if this is truly the debate, you know, was the fight was against modernism in so many fundamentalist groups. They couldn't escape modernism, though, you know, as a way of thinking. Even in some of my own dissertation writing, I've been playing with this idea of horizons and horizontal shifts,
where right, you know, I like it.
People is they have a horizon that says here is our way, here is our thinking, and yet they can't help what the next generation is going to take from their horizon and how it's going to shift from there. And that to me is kind of the interesting dynamic that we see at play here. So that's great that you point that out. And like you said, humility, right?
Mm-hmm.
What is it? How does it make us think about our own arguments and disagreements, right? Even in our own time.
Absolutely.
Another great thing that stood out, one of your chapters was on muscular Adventism. And I found this one especially interesting. Honestly,
I think that's my favorite chapter to write, Greg.
It was a great chapter, and it really tapped into, I felt, the wider American obsession with quite a few, you know, just masculine figures in the public mind. You know, you got Roosevelt, you got Dwight Moody, and just even like guys like Billy Sunday. You know, they're perpetuating this really strong sense of masculine Christianity that's ready to take up the banner and fight the good fight. The human dynamo was one of the other things you mentioned there. And I found that fascinating because what in your mind do you think was driving some of this new emphasis on stand up and be the man and fight for the cross? I mean, it almost had a crusader feel to it in my mind. You know, I can't help but go back to some of that earlier Christian church history, but it felt similar. How do you think and why do you think it kind of came up like this in this time?
Well, I think people are products of their culture and time and place and all of those kinds of things. For me, what really opened my eyes was a couple of friends, church historians, that had recommended a new book that had not even been released yet, Jesus and John Wayne by Kristen Dumais. I think Alicia Kaufman, who teaches at Baylor University, and there was a couple others that they said, hey, this is going to be a really significant book. So I think I was possibly the first or one of the very first in the Adventist community to both read that book and engage its ideas and promote it. And as I read Jesus and John Wayne, most of the book is focused on the 40s, 50s, 60s onward. But she has some introductory materials that are on Teddy Roosevelt and this muscular Christian movement that really begins in the early 20th century. So this, and Teddy Roosevelt was not a very religious person, but he used religion to his own purposes. And I think this is the same kind of thing. And so he's fusing ideas, and especially here's this guy that the Rough Riders and everything else trying to this bravado and everything else of the early 20th century. And he starts popularizing this, and he and others, but it wasn't just him, but he was, as the president of the United States, you know, just really this bravado and religion and fusing these things together. And so what was really amazing is I'm writing this book in the 20s, and researching this at that same time. And I begin reading in the review and in Signs and in Youth Instructor, all this same kind of rhetoric. And so there was clearly, again, back to Adventists being products of their time. And for me, I think the real tipping point was when I read this one article that I cite in there that talks about the ideal Adventist young man and a role model. And I thought, well, Luther or maybe James White. And then in the review, it says that the ideal young man should be like Teddy Roosevelt. If we had more Adventist young men like Teddy Roosevelt, then Jesus would come. That was kind of like this linchpin that said, oh my goodness, we were teaching muscular Christianity within Adventism. So I came up with the term muscular Adventism because, again, this is fusion of the muscular Christianity movement with Adventism, hence the muscular Adventism. But of course, not every Adventist believed this, but there's enough, and it's strong and prevalent enough that it's making a huge impact. And of course, I note that, you know, there's these eclipsing of women from leadership and ministry and Adventism. So there are very real and tangible results. I had a very good friend of mine who's doing a doctorate over in England right now. And he read that chapter and then looked up my original sources. And he said, he sent me a message, said, "Michael, you were too kind. You were really, you're laying it a little bit soft there on us." Because when he looked up the original sources that I cite in that chapter, he said, it's actually much stronger and more, you know, it was kind of this very blatant wake-up call that, hey, this was really a thing that impacted Adventism. And yeah. I was being very, very kind and generous in how I was using my sources. So there you have it.
I think that's what you said here is fascinating. Two things specifically. If we're like Teddy Roosevelt, if a young man were like Roosevelt, Jesus would come. Fascinating yeah. connection there. I didn't even see that in my head. But yeah. the idea that there's something we're doing that is keeping Jesus from coming back, we have to be that notion flows through Adventism in various stages.
Yes.
It's just fascinating to see that connected to Roosevelt here. The other thing you mentioned, though, is that women's role in the church took a nosedive around this time in history. And in the chapter, you highlighted things like the women's right to vote, the politics and all the policies that changed around the same time, and the fears of gender roles in many of these conservative Christian groups really mm-hmm. kind of drove this pushback against it. But what that highlights and tells me here is that even the things we argue about today in terms of women's ordination and other things have a root in this shift during fundamentalist times. I mean, is that what you're saying?
Well, absolutely. There's a clear tidal shift, and Adventism's never the same afterwards. And I've had people say, well, you know, what if only at 1919 they had done more to promote and teach? I'm not sure that if they'd even published the transcripts that it would have made much of a difference. There's a tidal shift in thinking and culture that is so strong and so overwhelming. I'm not sure that it would have made a difference. Of course, the what ifs of history, we don't know, but we sure. do see the tectonic plates moving in terms of race and gender. Now, I talk more about gender than I do of race in 1922. But I think in my 1925, the third volume of this trilogy is going to talk more about race specifically. Mm. And I did talk a little bit about it in a separate piece that I've published in some of my research that I presented at the American Society of Church History about Adventists and the Ku Klux Klan. And that came out as a separate standalone piece in Spectrum. So I think, you know, we're seeing just how much, you know, how did we ever get to the point where there were Adventists, even church leaders, who were supportive of the Ku Klux Klan in the 1920s? Yeah. That to me is rather shocking. But again, yeah. there's historical evidence. And the thing is, as a historian, we don't write the history that we wish we could write. We have to write the history that we've received that actually exists and that we can yeah. historically document. And so that's what I've tried to do, is be faithful as a historian to honestly describe and contextualize that history. And mm-hmm. that means the good, but also the bad, and the yeah. good we celebrate, and the challenging moments I hope are instructive that we can learn from.
Yeah. I mean, that sums up so much of the historian's necessity in church life, mm-hmm. to forget the good is bad. You know, we shouldn't forget the good, but to forget the bad is also bad.
Yeah.
It could help us understand where we're at today with so many of the issues our church faces, to realize where these issues really came from and who else was talking about it, and and why it has developed into our modern day controversies.
Yeah, and just to kind of come back to the opening then, you know, of how both the modernists and the fundamentalists were informed by modernist assumptions, but they're also trying to do the same thing, right? They're trying to keep and maintain the relevancy of the church and the world around them. They're just approaching it from two very different opposite kinds of methods or methodologies. And, you know, not all of fundamentalism is bad, right? So there's aspects in which fundamentalism is trying to highlight the supernatural aspects of the Bible. The Bible's divinely inspired, and that has application for a life, that the Bible is truly inspired by God. That desire is not a bad desire. That's actually a good desire, and one that I resonate with. So we highlight the good, but we also have to highlight the challenges.
Right. And I think that as historians, we've got to keep both of these things in tension, because it is hard. It's hard to write history with a fair and a balanced perspective, and not also sound like the older parent shaking the finger at the church and going, "We told you so." You know, like, it's hard to live in that tension.
And there's people today that want to, like, take sides, like, you know, that are very polemical, and that see themselves as the true purveyors of sort of a neo-fundamentalism or a neo-modernism. And that bifurcation of everything being black and white, I think, misses the nuance, and as if those are the only two options, as if we have to be a modernist or a fundamentalist. And I would say, honestly, that both approaches are not very helpful, to be quite frank.
No, they're both extreme. They both lose out the better of each other, right?
Yeah.
Hey, I've got a couple more parts here that really stood out to me. And again, want to just get some clarification from the author on this. Your chapter on weaponizing Ellen White, I found to be fascinating. That one stood out to me in the book, specifically because it showcased not only our tendency towards proof texting, right?
Yeah.
You know, just this idea that we're gonna drill down, and we are going to find all of the texts that we can throw at any given topic and prove our position.
Yeah.
But we took that mindset and have now changed it over into even how we view and read Ellen White. Interesting that this is the case, coming right on the heels of 1919. This is only a 3-year jump. And if you look at the transcripts from 1919, it doesn't feel like that's the direction we were headed.
Yeah.
What do you think happened? And why do you think we started to use her so much the same as we started using the Bible?
Yeah, so back to, I think this militant defense of the faith is one of the key marking points of fundamentalism. And you see, as there are increasing proclivity or tendencies towards fundamentalism within Adventism, you see also some people on the most extreme forms of that are not only proof texting, but taking this sort of, you know, double down, you know, no holding back, that, you know, we have to fight to defend the faith. And that militancy, which, you know, George Marsden and others have defined in the broader fundamentalist movement, you see that same sense of militancy. Now, part of it is a spillover, I think, of the cultural ethos of the era of World War I, that everything was being militarized. You're in this epic war that, you know, this great war that is transforming the world, as Christian nations are fighting each other and killing each other in ways and methods that are unprecedented in all of human history. And so that loss of life, that sense of need to defend and preserve life, is very much a part of that era. And it's not an accident that same sense of militancy spills over within Christian circles and within Adventist circles. So, yeah, you have to, well, how do you deal with, you know, perceived threats? And one way to do that is to militantly fight against it. And that's there. You have Holmes and Washburn, probably the best known and most extreme of these militant individuals who are fighting to defend the faith. And they are very much this war of words, this muckraking campaign that demonizes any and all who disagree with them. And they take this, you know, inerrantist, verbalist approach that exalts Ellen White's writings even above the Bible. So, you know, within her lifetime, it's Ellen White's writings are the lesser light to the greater light, which is Scripture, to Jesus. And they basically have reversed this, that Ellen White is the great criterion through which all else is evaluated. And some people say, you know, criticize them and said, well, you're making Ellen White into a pope, an infallible pope. And they're like, no, we
divine commentary, right?
Yeah, divine commentary. And they're like, no, she's far above and beyond that. And so did they stop to think about the rhetoric that they were saying? You know, this kind of, but yeah, this is what's happening, Greg. And it has a profound impact because it polarizes that kind of. That rhetoric polarizes and makes things much more extreme. And church leaders are fighting and struggling and wrestling with that because they're finding themselves caught at the crossroads between this really strong, extreme kinds of rhetoric. And at the end of the book, I'm pointing to people like W.A. Spicer, who basically is a church administrator, but he's kind of seeking a little bit more of a moderate way forward for Adventism. And that's what I'm really kind of appealing to, is that we don't have to be modernist or fundamentalist, that let's look for these third ways, or maybe fourth ways. I don't know that why only three ways, you know, but create the kinds of environments and conversations in a spirit of humility and dialogue that maybe there's other options that we can find constructive paths forward for the church, both back then, and I would even suggest for the church today.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that's, that appeal is in so many ways is super resonant with myself. I've always felt like more of the moderate in many things, theological and historical, but that also feels like, well, we can only fight two fronts because nobody ever seems to like the moderate viewpoint, whether you're on one extreme or the other. I love that you point out Wilcox there at the end, because he did have that sense of moderation. Mm-hmm. And it felt like a small voice, but it was an important voice, especially, you know, with the Washburn and Holmes and, you know, the other factions that are out there.
Yeah.
Last big question. And I think this one's just more of the, a sense of your place within the historiographic spectrum. What do you hope 1922 as a book, but also as perhaps part of the larger trilogy that you're making, what do you hope it's going to do for the church in our own current discussions and controversies that we're engaged in as a church?
Yeah. So I really hope, Greg, that it creates thoughtful moments to ponder the past, and the past is not the present. So I want to avoid the fallacy of presentism. I'm not here to try to, you know, the past is the same as today. It's not. The past, and studying the past, is far more complex and nuanced than that. But I do hope it gives us reason and moments to pause, to reflect and say, you know, are those same kinds of issues? We still respond and struggle with change as a church, as a society. We're dealing with, we have another war that's unfolding in the world around us. These kinds of, so we deal with the same kinds of challenges. I tried to explain, you know, some people have suggested, well, our early Adventist pioneers were fundamentalist. And I would say, no, you can't have a fundamentalist movement before there was fundamentalism, before there was a historical movement. That doesn't mean that people haven't dealt with change over time in similar kinds of issues and similar kinds of ways. And so that is still very much a reality, Greg. And so I hope that, instead of saying, hey, there's the modernism, the modernists and the fundamentalists, and the modernists are going to think I'm fundamentalist and the fundamentalists are going to think I'm modernist, right? And that's not a guarantee I'm a moderate either, but I am seeking for moderation and for new ways of conversation to create spaces in the middle between the extremes, that maybe there are ways of understanding inspired writings and studying the Bible and understanding Adventism that don't have to be quite so polarized. So I really hope 1922 creates space for constructive conversations within the church overall writ large that can help us to better both understand our history, but also in doing so in the historiographical tradition of our church, that will allow us to say, hey, how can we approach new issues in the church, and are those, you know, are is a bifurcated, a black and white approach, is that always the best approach? Could there be third ways, third options, more, you know, space in the middle, or other methods and approaches that could help us create spaces for conversation. So, and I think closely related to that, and I've tried to highlight this, is a sense of humility as we study the past, as we study our history, that it gives us moments for pause to say, you know, I wonder if maybe, you know, I may not be right about something. And so if not, then maybe my ways of thinking and approaching things, maybe that there's other ways of seeing things. And it may not mean that I necessarily change my mind, but if we can see and understand better why other people are thinking the way they do, that also will give us a bits of moments for pause, and creating those safe spaces and conversations through a sense of humility. So I hope 1922 helps us better understand our history in a more meaningful and historically accurate way, and creating constructive conversations and a sense of humility. So that's what I'm really hoping. Whether it does that or not, I don't know. I'm a little bit proud of the fact that on Amazon, it was like the number one new release in the Seventh-day Adventist category. Not that's a huge category, but for 27 out of 30 days of the first month that it was out. So that encourages me that people are reading and resonating with it. So hopefully that continues.
I hope so. And I think your reason for existence and bringing this book about is a fantastic one. So thanks for clarifying that one. Well, hey, folks, we've had a good discussion here. If you have not had a chance yet to go off and buy the book 1922 by Michael Campbell, I highly recommend it, not just because I'm biased and he's my co-host, but because, frankly, it's a seminal work. Nobody else is looking at this in quite the same way. So if you want to know and understand early 20th century Adventism and how it affects us today, go check out the book. It's been fantastic.
Thanks, Greg. Thanks for having me. I know we co-host together, but it's fun to be able to share some of our own research. And by the way, a little sneak preview. Greg's getting towards the end of his own doctoral studies. So in a very soon episode, I hope, we're going to be talking about some of his research too. So we'll have a little bit of fun together, because not only do we talk about other people's research, but we want to contribute to that conversation too.
Absolutely. And I can't wait to finish that.
I bet.
All right. Well, Adventist Pilgrimage Podcast listeners, thanks again. Hope you come back to us next month. We've got a lot of new stuff coming. The summer is not going to slow down. It's just going to get busier, actually. So thank you for joining us. Have a great week.
And Jesus himself said that he did not come to do away with the law.
Take us out of this world if he does not want us to be contaminated.